Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club and the Bay Gourmet Forum with our special guest, Paula Wolfert, author of The Food of Morocco. I'm Patty Untermans, today's moderator. I'd also like to thank Bernard Osher Foundation for their sponsorship of this program. And you can find out more about the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Well, you know, I'm so happy to be here because Paula Wolfert is my hero, and she's a hero to many generations of serious cooks in the Bay Area and in the world. You know, I'm going to make this a little very short, but I just want to tell you that there are so many cookbooks on the market, but every serious cook needs about three authors: Diana Kennedy, Julia Child, if they want to learn how to cook French food, Marcella Hazan for Italian, and Paula Wolfert. I mean, that's it. If you have that collection of cookbooks and you're a human being in the Western Hemisphere, you are covered. You need nothing else.
I'm looking around to see who you're talking about.
I'm
humbled.
She is that important, because she's not only covered Morocco here, but the whole rim of the Mediterranean and the Eastern Mediterranean
and Southwest France,
which was so great. And so you're my hero, Paula, and how great. And I was very, very excited to see this absolutely new book about the food of Morocco, because, in fact, it is so beautiful, so exciting, so full of color. It just makes me excited. It's almost like a revisiting. And, you know, there's a little quote at the beginning from Edith Wharton that you quote. It says, "To touch the past with one's hands," and that idea is so extraordinary. Can you tell us a little bit about why you use that quote? And
well, Edith Wharton's quote, when I first saw it, and I thought back to when I first read it, which was not that long ago, but when I remembered back to my first time in Morocco, which was in 1959, coming from New York, having once been to Florida, never really having left New York, my first husband and I took a tramp steamer, one of these old Liberty ships, across the ocean, 12 days, and the captain said, "You know, we're here in Casablanca for 2 days. There's nothing to see here." And it was true. There was nothing to see there in 1959. It was just a lot of slums and a port. He said, "Why don't you go down to this city called Marrakesh? You take the bus, blah, 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 and stay overnight and come back tomorrow, and we'll take you up to Tangier," where I was going. Why was I going to Tangier? I'm just going to give you a footnote. Because in the 20s, you went to Paris. In the 50s, if you were a beatnik, you went to Tangier. Okay? So we went down to Marrakesh, and it was late August, and all I can tell you is that it was like being in a time machine of like 600 years. It wasn't the Marrakesh you see today with all the tourists and everything. It was a very different Marrakesh, and I was totally thrown in like in a whirlwind. And when I read that quote, that's what happened to me. I was touched. And I have had this almost 50-year love affair with Morocco. I lived there 7 years. I raised my children part of the time there. The other part, they lived in Paris, born in Paris. And I kept going back, and it kept changing. But I think we're going to wait to talk about that.
So when you first arrived in Morocco, 10% of the people were living in the cities. 90% of the people were living in the countryside. And now, 80% of the people in Morocco are living in the cities. Tell me what that means in terms of the cooking there. And
well,
how.
When I lived there, and you'd have to say it's from 59 to 76 with some breaks. I mean, 8 years in Paris and some other places. It was pretty much like it probably always was. I lived in the countryside. I did not live in the city of Tangier. I lived up in the country. And we did everything like our neighbors. We made our own bread. We grew some of our own vegetables, but we also went in every day to the souks. And I just fell into it because it was just a kind of, it was playtime. I mean, that's what I thought of it at first. And the food, cooking was done very laboriously and took all day, and women didn't have anything else to do. I tried to write a book about this kind of cooking, and I put everything into Le Creuset pots for Americans to make it easy. I really worked very hard to keep the taste as best I could, but I was working against every odds. The only people who bought fresh food or fresh fruits were the vegetarians who, you know, I mean, people, you'd have to understand, remember back in the 60s, 70s? I mean, people just didn't, you know, they just bought frozen foods, garbage. And so I had to tell people to go to their vegetarian store the day they found out the vegetables were arriving, because they didn't even take good care of them there. And then the spices were off. I mean, they were old and they were ground. But I wrote it. This is what it looked like. This is when it came out in 73. Would you believe it? It's still in print. I mean, that's something. But I mean, I made it work. But it wasn't right. I knew it wasn't right, but I made it work because Moroccan food really does taste good. In fact, it tastes so good that Paul Bocuse once said, there are three great cuisines in this world. Actually, if I had been around, I would have said to him, no, there are five, because I would have had Mexican and Indian. But anyway, he said, there's French, there's Chinese, and there's Moroccan. Nobody knows how good Moroccan food is. Nobody has ever really dug into it, because all people ever try to do, including myself, is try to change it and make it work for you. The funny thing is, now, with this 80% that are in the city, and they have a lot of problems, but I'm not going to talk about that yet. I want to talk about what happened to me. For the first time in these last 20 years or 10 years, everything is available here. First of all, we have better vegetables now than we've ever had. We have wonderful meats. If we could just get them to not be so fattened up, would be better, but never mind. We have all the spices. We have everything available to us, and we even have tagines. And we can now produce the food the way I tasted it, when it was absolutely magnificent. Which brings us to something called the magic of the tagine. Do you want to go on to that, or
yes,
should we?
Yes, absolutely. Okay.
We always cooked in tagines when I lived in Morocco, because we had a stove, but we didn't have an oven. And the stove only had two burners, so a lot of the cooking had to be done in these little majas, which were these little earthenware bowls that held the coals. And it took 3 hours to cook the food in these clay pots, and it really did taste better. And on top of the stove, we did some other cooking as well. And I had some metal pans because, you know, I was a little bit into speed. But we ate from the tagine. And if people say, what is it about the tagine that's so special? Well, I'm sure you've all heard the clay makes food taste better. I'm sure you've all heard about the recycling of the moisture, that this cone-shaped pan with its shallow bottom, everything is piled into it. The food is slowly cooked. At first, it throws off a lot of moisture. You don't even put any water in. Where in my book here, you had to put in 2 cups. You don't put any water in. There's this recycling of moisture. It goes up. The top of the tagine is very cold, but slowly, slowly, over a period of time, you don't have to do anything. You could go and watch a movie or something. You could just let it sit on top of a heat dispenser, on top of the stove, because it's bottom-up cooking, like Paul Bertoli talks about. And eventually, the moisture is reabsorbed by the vegetables and the meat. Richer people have more meat. Poorer people have less meat. And the whole cone gets hot. And at this moment, the tagine becomes a portable oven and bakes and browns, allows the meat to brown. Brown is done in reverse. Okay? Now, that's the magic of the tagine, but it doesn't end there. What happens at the table? I'm going to make an aside now. Footnote. If you go to an Ethiopian restaurant, are you willing to eat with your hands? Yeah. Okay. Please, eat with your hands with Moroccan food. The first three fingers of your right hand, with bread. You don't put your fingers into the food. Of course, you wash them before you sit down. But everybody eats from the same plate, and it's only polite to eat from what's facing you. There's six of you at the table, okay? There's looks like enough food. If I had taken all that food and put it on six plates, it would look like it's not enough for you. Oh, dear, who's at the door? Four more people have just shown up. No problem. Just a little bit more sideways, okay? It's called baraka. The tagine has baraka. It will feed everyone. It will feed everyone. They'll be given their bread, and you will just eat less, but it doesn't come out as less. You feel fulfilled. You are close to the people at your table. There's hospitality. There's warmth. There's conversation. When you eat like that, it's so beautiful. Okay. What happened when I went back in the 90s? And all these people, this 80%, moved into cities. They don't really have quite the place to cook all their tagines the way I wanted them to continue cooking them. And they started putting them in pressure cookers. They still served it in a tagine because Moroccans have to feed a large amount of people. So they still do that. But young people were a little uncomfortable about 20 years ago. They sort of liked McDonald's, and they sort of liked getting away and maybe not being with their parents all the time because television and everything showed that you can be out there and be a free person. And things were getting away. This reminds me of back in the 60s when people were eating frozen foods here in the United States, and then all of a sudden this woman gets on television with this 6-foot frame and gets everybody, a new generation of people, excited about food because their mothers were making frozen food and they wanted to know the real thing. Well, guess what? In Morocco, in the last 10 years, there's a woman who gets on television. Her name is Chumicha. She gets on television, and the whole new generation of girls in the cities are cooking on tagines. That's true. So, I mean, it's really in their blood, just like it's really in our blood to eat with our families, and maybe not cook French food, but to eat with our families, to cook for our families. Why are we all here? We're all here because we're interested in food. And this happened because of Julia, and it's now rekindling in the cities of Morocco. I know I'm going very fast, but I only have an hour, and I have so much.
Well, Paula, you told me that you have a Facebook group,
yeah,
right?
2,400 members.
2,400 members, many of whom are in Morocco.
Yes. Yes, well, that's. I started it about 6 months ago. It's in English, and anybody can join. You just have to, if you find it hard, just befriend me, and then you get in. I don't turn anybody away. And we have a lot of Moroccan women who are interested in food, and Moroccans have a very easy time. If they're educated, there's five American schools around Morocco, a lot of people read and write English. And we have a lot of American girls married to Moroccans. And really, I get up sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning and I just check my group because I'm the administrator. And I notice that the New Zealanders and the Australians are starting to talk to each other. And by 5 in the morning, California time, all of a sudden it's it's all these girls in Casablanca and Rabat and Marrakesh sharing things. And, you know, do you notice the Eid, you know, Eid al-Kabir is coming up where everybody has to kill their own lamb. And they're already starting to talk about this. And then I've got chefs in Australia who have, I actually been to Australia, so I know one of the chefs. And he has a big Moroccan restaurant there now. So, and I have other people. And then starts the New Yorkers and we move across. And by the time it's noon here, so I got everybody in there, and we share. We talk about art, music, food, and travel, And we don't talk politics, but and if anybody does anything very insulting, I'm the administrator, they're out. They're gone. They disappear. So it's please join, or at least go to Facebook, Moroccan Cooking Groups. It's Moroccan Cooking Group. There are two of them, because when I was trying to figure out how to do it, I started four by mistake. Then I had to move everybody, but I couldn't get rid of one of them because my friend Nancy Jenkins was giving me so much trouble. I said, you know what, I'm just going to leave you in that group alone, Nancy. So I've got two groups, Nancy and myself in one, which is a closed group. She's a very good friend of mine. And then the rest, I got them all together, and I've got a lot of chefs. And I have a lot of people from India too. I have people from everywhere.
Well, I mean, what's interesting though, I mean, this group sounds very exciting, is that current Moroccans are almost trying to rediscover their own traditional cooking.
Well, that's true.
And with this woman on the
Chumicha. Well, Chumicha. She does it in Arabic, and my Arabic was pretty good a long time ago because I had an extraordinary experience. Living with a family that didn't speak anything but Arab, when I was working on this book for 6 weeks, I was placed in the home of a woman who had been the dada for King Muhammad.
Is that who this book is dedicated to?
Yes. It's a long story. It's too long for this. But anyway, the thing is that I moved in with her, and my boyfriend took care of my kids up in Tangier. And I moved into her house, and she had been the retired dada for King Muhammad Sank, the late grandfather of the present king. And she was told and given money to teach me everything. And we very much loved each other. I mean, 6 weeks, you know, the Moroccan, especially Berber people, they just hug all the time. It's all they do is kiss. And I'm a big kiss person. I've learned, traveling all over the Mediterranean, you kiss a woman on each cheek, touch your heart, give her a present, you're in. You're one of them. And I sleep over. I never stay in hotels. I got to sleep in your house. I don't care where. I got to know what you like. I mean, this is from Soviet Georgia, now regular Georgia, all the way to Morocco. That's how I operate. So anyway, she and I bonded. And then the government... So her son in the government got me a way to go all the way through the country. And in every town, I was the main dish was taught to me. But this was a long time ago. And the Moroccan government was really hoping it would be a book like this, with lots of color pictures and everything. And they were going to buy a lot of copies. But Harper Monroe didn't think anybody was interested in Moroccan cooking. And the man who had helped me, there's a picture of his mother in the book, and it's a very unattractive picture. I did not take the picture. A Moroccan took the picture, and it was given to the I don't know where it is. It's at the, and it was given to here. This was the woman. I don't know if you can see. She looks like she's in tattered clothes. That's the way she liked to dress. That's the way she cooked. And when we had it, there was a story done in a local magazine in Morocco, and they took this picture of her, and we used it in the book. And he was really mad at me. He was mad at me until he saw this book. And he saw I dedicated the book.
Well, so this brings up, I mean, you say in both these books that Moroccan, that there are kind of two strands in Moroccan cooking, a Berber cultural strand and an Arab strand.
Right.
So what are the differences? Tell us about that.
Well, the Berber is more the country food and the Arabs. But you have to look back. Can I give you a little history of Morocco? I mean, there was once upon a time there were elephants in Morocco. I mean, it's been there a long time. But the Berbers were the original people of the region. And there have been discoveries in the land, and you know, digs, 2000 BC, of clay sieves for steaming, and not really tagines, but type of bowls that look like tagines with a cone. The Berbers invented the tagine, and they invented the steaming of couscous and clay. This is true. Okay. So that has been proven with these old shards or whatever they put together. In 70 AD, with the fall of the temple in Israel, the Jews came across to North Africa. The world stopped there. Remember the flat? And the Berbers embraced them, showed them how to live on the mountains with them. And Berbers and Jews lived very happily for about 700 years. Some even converted to Judaism. Some of the, you know, went into marriage or whatever they did. And they learned the cooking, which was very primitive at that time. And then the Arabs came across, brought the spice trade, and brought themselves, took over the country, and Jews, Christians, Arabs, and Berbers all were in Spain together as they moved north and made what was called the Arab Andalus. This was in the 7th, 8th century, okay? They taught. Each group taught the others things for agriculture, for using spices, all the stuff that came from the Persian palaces. The Arabs taught them how to use spices in cooking. I mean, amazing amount of spices. They learned about growing olive trees, dates, grapes. All this came with the Arabs. But meanwhile, the Spanish were doing other things and taught them about getting the rivers to move so that you could flood more ranges to get more production of food. And they grew things, and they really had an incredible 700 years of poetry, art, architecture, everything. It was, and Paris was nothing. I mean, you know, nothing was happening anywhere else. This is where it was happening. Isabel and Ferdinand kicked them out, they started a war from northern Spain and moved south and got rid of the Jews, the Berbers, and the Arabs. They went to go back into North Africa. I mean, you know all this, but I'm just filling it in for those who might not have known this story. And then there was the discovery of the New World, and you had the Columbian Exchange. You know the Columbian Exchange?
Well, yes. Yes.
We got syphilis and they got...
Tomatoes,
they got peppers. And we got eggplant. So it's a big thing, the Columbian Exchange. And then, of course, everything, you know, everywhere it was. But Bocuse was right. You know, they had a great cuisine then, and it developed. It developed in the countryside, and it developed in the very small palaces around. There were four palaces in Morocco, and it developed into a more refined cuisine over the next couple of hundred years. So there is this palace cuisine, elegance, lots of meat, grilled meats. You know, the Moroccans also claim they invented the grilled meats. I'm not so sure about that. And then the Berbers had their, you know, they lived up in the mountains and they had their ways of making things, their ways of making cheeses, their ways of preserving butters, culturing butters, and they have many, many things which have moved along. But the tagine was Berber and was adopted by everyone. And steaming grains. Now, when the Arabs came, I left this out, when the Arabs came, and this is where Charles Perry and I don't really agree on things, but when the Arabs came, they brought with them semolina flour. And durum flour had the ability to expand upon being wet. And when you steamed it, it gets larger. And steam it again, it gets larger and larger and larger. Up until that time, and we're talking about a couple of thousand years, they were steaming lotus flowers. They were steaming all kinds of seeds or anything because that was the way they cooked. They cooked going up. They had one little fire and they had to keep, you know, it was double decker, triple decker cooking. So that's why the couscous the air was like that. And couscous was always there, esteemed. Doesn't always have to be called couscous. It had other names. But it was food. It was just steamed food. But when they saw that they could take these semolina grains, wet them, steam them, sun-dry them, And today, put them in a box and sell it to you as instant couscous, because that's what it was. Because every box of instant couscous made with 100% semolina is exactly the same as Moroccan couscous. They then take it, wet it again, steam it again two more times, and they have
That's a couscous. Big relief for all of us home cooks. Let me just interject.
Never mind whole wheat couscous or anything like that. That's not...
Right. So you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're talking with Paula Wolfert and her new cookbook, The Food of Morocco. I'm Patty Underman. All right. So you were talking about the tagine is eating from the tagine and cooking. Tagines are like just the central part of Moroccan cooking. You just told me just recently that there's really hardly any difference between cooking couscous and cooking a tagine. Tell us the difference about that.
Well, there's two things. The tagine is a very shallow, thick sauce that you eat with bread. Couscous is a very thin, brothy sauce, not sauce, a broth, with the same vegetables, the same meat, but it dampens a pile of lightly fluffy couscous. It is exactly the same. When these 80% were living in the countryside, they had room to make couscous all the time. They made it 2-3 times a week. When they moved into their little tiny apartments in Casablanca or Marrakesh or Fez, they really started switching more to tagines. Same ingredients, same spices, just no water. And, well, a little tiny bit of water, depends. But the thing is that it's the same dish, except they eat bread instead of the couscous because of the mess, the big mess that it can make in some places. I mean, you have to face it. I mean, it's making your own couscous unless you have the type of bowl. You can get it at farm stand. What do you call those things? It's a kassar in Moroccan, but it's just a big bowl. Mixing bowl, but bigger, wider. Okay, so they switched more to tagines. But there are certain holidays, there are weddings, there are certain Friday, which is a prayer day and everything. People go back and eat couscous because it's traditional. But it really wasn't that much of a jump for them. It's the same thing. Now, some people say, well, what about vegetarian food? I mean, you know, everybody always wants to eat vegetarian. I'd like to go do vegetarian, too, if I really could give up meat, but I can't. But you can't. In Morocco, tradition still exists. You cannot have somebody over to your house and make them a vegetarian couscous or a vegetarian tagine. Meat is a symbol. It's a very strong symbol, not how rich you are, but how much you value them, the visitor. It's just one of those things. They have it in their tradition. So if you are going to have Moroccans over, unless they are so savvy for a vegetarian, you better think about a little meat.
So you, one thing that you discuss here that sounds very exotic and interesting is this meat confit.
Yes. You know, Moroccans confit everything. Lemons, all these pickled preserved olives, lots of pickled vegetables. I mean, everything is preserved because they were up in the mountains. Preserved meat. In France, in southern France, I mean, you have ventresse. In Italy, you got pancetta. In other countries, I mean, in Turkey, you got pastirma. It is not something that you put on your plate and you just eat. It's a seasoning. They take lamb, camel, or beef. I'm not kidding. Camel used to be very popular in Fez. It was considered very delicious. I never had it that I knew of. But anyway, I've been told it's delicious. And they make it first into a beef jerky type thing. Then they season it, and then they cook it in fat, rendered fat, and then they hold on to it for a year or two and use it in shredded pieces and things. In every one of my books, I have a dish for kalia, and I talk about hanging the meat up in the sun during the day. I have all this stuff that I was just telling you about. I wasn't meaning to do it. Along comes these ladies in Rabat who say, I have no room to make, you know, meat confit the right way. And somebody comes up with express meat, an express version. And I give an express version, and it's delicious. It takes one day.
So how do you do it?
You don't do the drying part. You just season it, and you cook it in suet, and then you can keep it up to 2 weeks.
So it's more like a duck confit,
yes,
kind of thing.
But here's the fun part. So I'm writing about this on my group, and so this guy, you know, in Tampa, he introduces, he's a car dealer, but he's gone into a private little business on the side because he's got his great-grandmother's recipe from Fez, and he is making for the Moroccan population in the United States the old way, the dried-up old way of doing it, which is much stronger, very delicious, and he sells it online, and every once in a while we discuss it, and we have put up pictures of what it looks like, and different members will tell dishes that they made with it, and I use it, and I have it because it keeps all year, as opposed to mine, which only keeps 2 weeks.
And you say it tastes, it's sort of like bacon, like if you
it tastes like bacon, but
it's with egg,
that's halloof.
Oh, well, I know, but
it tastes like bacon, yeah. It crisps up like bacon. And fried eggs with meat confit, whether you buy his, called Moroccan Khli, K-H-L-I-I. It's in the back of the book. I have it in the back of the book anyway. Because I give recipes using both. In when I finished this book, I was starting already. I already had the back to do. So I knew I could tell people about it. You could use it. So you can use it. It's not that expensive.
And so eggs cooked with it.
Fried eggs with it, yeah. It's delicious. I showed you a picture.
It's the most delicious-looking picture. On radio, you can't see it, unfortunately, but take my word for it.
It's fried eggs with pieces of bacon, but it isn't bacon. It's little shreds. So anyway, but I also have it for the soups and for – it's because it's used all over the country. It's poor people's food, but just like – you know, poor people's food, like bacon with, you know, pancetta is poor people's food. It gets used to make really good, rich people's food.
And so we can get that online. The tagines, we can get beautiful tagines. Right. We can go up to Sonoma
But there's one thing. Yeah. You don't have to buy anything from the supermarket except one thing you absolutely have to buy online. And that is real cumin from Morocco.
Oh.
Let me tell you why. This was the biggest surprise to me, because when I lived in Morocco, we only used Moroccan cumin. I never could find it in America when I came home, but I went and used the Mexican cumin. A young man moved to the United States to go to college in Seattle, and he used to play basketball with my son, so I knew him. And now he's an importer. His name is Mustafa. Mustafa's preserved lemons, Mustafa's Ras El Hanout, and he brings in the cumin, and he sent me some to try. First of all, you don't even need to toast it. It's so strong. That's number one. And two, you only grind it when you're ready to use it. And the trick is a pinch of salt. I did this on, Martha Stewart's show. She didn't know how to grind cumin. All you have to do is put a pinch of salt, and it grinds to a powder. And you use it ground at the moment you're going to use it. The smell, it's like the whole house, all of a sudden, is Morocco. That one ingredient, and it's not that expensive. It's just that one ingredient. If you could do everything else from Whole Foods, but maybe they carry some of Mustafa's stuff. They may have it now. They have his preserved lemons.
It's a different species, or
yes, and the earth. It's the earth. It's the earth. It's like wine, like grapes.
Wow.
I mean, you know, it has a different taste, and it is slightly different. It doesn't smell like Mexican cumin, but anyway, that to me is the most important. Sure, argan oil. You've all heard about argan oil. You know, there's three dishes in the book, in case there's somebody who wants to try it. I mean, it's delicious, but it's expensive. But there are other things. But most Moroccan food now, you can get everything at Whole Food or at our farmers markets.
Great. But, you know, reading this book makes you want to just get on a plane and go to Morocco. And if one were to do that, how should we eat? What should we do?
Okay. Everybody, now we have if I'm a Moroccan, they have some very good restaurants now. It used to be terrible. Every restaurant served the same food everywhere. And I remember when you and your husband went, I said, don't take a plate with you and eat from the street.
Yeah,
street food is better than most restaurant food. But it's changed. I mean, there are now some really good food done in restaurants. The problem is if it's not the belly dancers in the way, which is not Moroccan, or it's that they serve everything, you know, they serve too much on a plate because you don't really need, they won't serve it to you the way they do in Morocco, you know, in the home. But if you go to the Jemaa el Fennah, which is this big center arena in Marrakesh, at nighttime, they set up circles and circles and circles of food stands, and they are selling everything there that's homemade cooking, and you're eating it as if it's homemade cooking. You're eating with your fingers and everything. These are not for tourists. These are for Moroccans. How do you know which one to go to? Just go and stand on the line with the longest amount of people with their children and family. It'll be the best price, and the food is good. It's fresh, and it's good.
You can do that in every town?
No, not. But there's food. Street food is big in Morocco. Always been big. But when we lived in the north, when I used to go into Tangier, my daughter told me, I never would have thought to do this, but she once, with a bunch of her, because she was the only American in the class, but with a bunch of friends, they went, before they went into the movies, they bought fried sardine sandwiches. They fried sardines, they put them in bread, and they carried them into the movie theater, and they went, I don't know, I guess it's okay. There's also a type of saka, you know, like farinata. In Tangier, and at the schoolyard afterwards, when they come out, all the kids buy it, and they put that in bread. So I have to talk about it, the CIA, the odd breads, and I started to remember, oh, my God, that's still going on. I mean, that's what Moroccans like. They do eat street food, but they eat it with bread, even things that we wouldn't, but you can taste it. Now, get out a pencil and paper. I want you to write down what I'm going to pronounce. Because if you do go to Morocco and you do go to the Jemaa el Fennah, you're going to need this one sentence to get people to leave you alone. Because like everywhere else in this world, there's not a lot of work, and young people will bother you if they see you're different. You're going to say La Barakalafik, which means La, no, Barakalafik, which means good fortune to you. Barak. Remember I told you Baraka? Baraka, Allah. God is going to look after you, I promise you. That's what you're saying. It's a real, they love you for it. They can't believe that you said it, number one. And I'll repeat it slowly for you. But they can't believe you said it. But the fact that you said it, they move and they bow away because you are giving them the blessing that they cannot sneer. They cannot bother you again because you have given them God's blessing. La Barakalofik. It's not any other Arab country. It's just Morocco, and it's really northern Morocco, but all the Moroccans know it now. Is there anybody in this room who's Moroccan? No? Okay. Well, because maybe I'm not pronouncing it exactly right, but that's the way I've always pronounced it, and I learned it from my housekeeper. She always said, anybody bother you, just say that, and they will love you and leave you alone. Huh? La Barak, Barak, B-A-R-A-C-K, Barak Kalofik, Ka-lofik, Barak Kalofik, La Barak Kalofik.
So on.
And that?
I think that's one of the most brilliant travel tips I've ever heard. Fantastic. And on that note, do we have any questions for Paula? Here's your chance to ask about.
Yes.
What makes Moroccan food so distinctive to categorize it as one of the three or five great cuisines?
What makes Moroccan food?
One of the things is it had a palace culture. It had a tremendous use of a variety of fine ingredients that grew in the country. We're talking about spices, we're talking about vegetables, just what I described earlier about what happened during the Arab Andalus. And there is also a history of minglings of people so that they learned from each other. All of these things bring a cuisine into another level. The Moroccan cuisine is a very delicious, very, very refined cuisine, which for a short time looked like it was going to disappear. But it's it's going to be saved because books are being written now. You know, when I lived there, the only way you learned a dish from somebody else was when you went to a wedding party. You had to help the mother prepare all the food. So everybody who was friends brought their own majar and tagine, because they were portable tagines, and would cook together. So this business that women keep their recipes to a secret isn't really true. I mean, I just read that somebody said that, and it isn't true. Women do share their secrets.
It's the men that don't share, right?
No, the men are new to cooking. The men are new to cooking. You had a question? You had a question? So you did. Well, I think Aziza is a California Moroccan restaurant. It isn't Moroccan. It's California Moroccan. I know Murad very well. He used to call me his mentor, but I mean, you like all people, you eventually go off on your own tangent. And he has, and he's a one-star Michelin. But it isn't Moroccan. It's Moroccan-inspired. I don't know a Moroccan restaurant here in San Francisco, and I wouldn't go to one. I'd go to Murad's because he doesn't do what I would do at home, and if he did what I did at home and I didn't like it as much, I'd probably never go back. So I don't want to know. I only want to taste his food because it's about him. It's chef's food.
I know that they're making couscous from scratch every morning.
Oh, I know. Yes,
you know,
they all have my book, and they all learn it from my book. Yes,
beautiful.
Yeah, well,
one guy just dedicated to making couscous. But so it's true, you can get some elements that are very, very traditional, but then he goes off on a tangent in other ways.
But he's very talented, you will get something of the spirit of some of the food. But it isn't, I just read, you know, I don't know, I'm sure there are restaurants here in the United States. It just never would occur to me to go to a restaurant and eat Moroccan food. I just wouldn't. I mean, if somebody, it's home cooking. Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Could you speak a little bit more about the difference in the spices? For example, I can tell if I'm smelling some kind of Moroccan azalin or something like that versus a curry. But I don't know.
Okay, there is a Moroccan, there are two or three Moroccan blends in Morocco, one called Ras El Hanout, another called Misakhen, which are particular blends that work like MSG. They bring up the flavor of food. And they're similar to curry in the sense that they're used like curry, but they have different spices in them. They do have turmeric. By the way, what I would like to just mention, since you brought this up, is that Moroccan food is very healthy because it has such similarities with Indian food, which is very healthy, on the level of the spicing. The ginger, the turmeric, the nutmeg, the licorice, all these are very healthy spices. And in fact, when you go to Morocco, where I lived, in near Tangier, the British church had their, you know, church meetings on Sunday, you go to church, but right across the street was an old guy who did magic, just in case you felt like that wasn't going to work for you. And he had things like foxtails hanging, just in case you wanted to feel a little foxy or something. There was all kinds of, there's my husband. There was all kinds of voodoo type stuff that they still do, but they use spices also for medicinal reasons. And aphrodisiac reasons. Nutmeg is an aphrodisiac. But there's also monk's pepper. Figure out what that does. But I have a 700-page book called the Cuisine, the Pharmacopoeia Marocaine. It's out of print, but it's in French. And it goes through all the spices in Morocco, the spice mixtures in Morocco, the blends, and how they're used medicinally and in cooking. I mentioned Misakhen. Everybody knows about Ras El Hanout, the 25 spices or so. But Misakhen is even more interesting because it's a woman's spice. It's women cooking for other women, helping them get pregnant or helping them not get pregnant. It's a particular group of spices, and I discuss it in the book, which is made with chicken and lentils and things. It's done differently throughout the country. It's a particularly delicious dish. And that kind of spirit and use, they believe in it. And women to this day still practice. If somebody wants to get pregnant, they will have this particular dish, and all the women will bring together their best recipes and spices, and or you'll have it made for you at the local atta, the spice market, and add it to the chicken dish to bring up the flavor. And if one of the women is already pregnant, she can't eat it. Those are their laws.
Do you make your own blend?
Well, you know what? I used to, but now there are so many good blends on the market, and Mustafa has a really good blend. I have a number of recipes in my book which dumbed down a bit, which I find very, very good. But Mustafa told me that he just switched in the last couple of years. He switched from one spice master to another because he got a better Ras Al Hanout mix. But he also has a number two for chicken dishes, and he has a number one for beef dishes, and he has a number three for fish, because they're different spices that bring up the flavor. So, and every family, you know, some people don't like aphrodisiacs in their food. And some people do. but what you're going to buy here in the United States is always going to be safe. You don't have to worry.
Yes.
You talked about the Spanish and the Arab influence. What about the French influence in Moroccan food? Has there been much, or has it gone the other way from Morocco?
Well, they didn't get in there till 1908. And as I pointed out, the food was really set back in 1492. So what they picked up from the French is new. They just picked up some modern things like baguettes. The Moroccan bread, yes, but baguettes is one thing that I used to see. No, I didn't really feel that the French gave that much, but because, yes, absolutely, couscous is the most popular dish in France right now among a lot of people, so it is the other way. But when we lived there, Spanish cooking was very popular in the north. French cooking in Casablanca, only because there were a lot of French people living there. But once they were kicked out in 1957 in the revolution, it faded. And now, of course, they're back in droves. All of Marrakesh, the old part of Marrakesh, all the people moved out into modern apartments, and all these interior decorators and all the people from Paris. So we have a lot of French restaurants now in Marrakesh.
French hoteliers.
Pardon me?
And French owners of Riyadh.
Yes, French owners of Riyadh, yeah. Beautiful. And now that you stay in them, they're lovely. And that's where you'll get home cooking, because they'll always have a woman who will prepare the foods.
Well, we have, one last question?
Yes, I have many, many, many more breads than I did in my first book. In my first book, I only did the bread that my housekeeper made, which was the bread we made at home. But I didn't really pay much attention to all the skillet breads. But in this book, I go very heavily into it. And to harsha, which is the type of bread made with doesn't even have a no knead. You know how we have no knead bread? They have a no knead bread too. You don't have to knead it. It just allows the water to soak into the semolina, and it expands, and then you just pat it into little patty cakes and fry and skillet fry.
Which sounds, there's one recipe for that bread where it's crumbled up and a guinea hen stew goes over it. It is just sounds so luscious, but I realized it would take about 3 days to do it. First you'd have to make the bread.
No. It has no yeast in the bread. It's made with this, you take coarse semolina and you just wet it, and while it's expanding, remember I told you semolina expands, you make your guinea hen stew.
So
and then you fry this big pancake, and then you crumble it.
And then
it's still hot.
And put the, so it's,
yeah, the whole thing takes the same amount of time. It's coordinated.
Oh, it's just, I can smell it as I read it.
You know, that was one of the few breads, that was one of the few dishes I got online. I joined a Moroccan, in French language, forum called Yabiladi. And I was asking about uses for harsha besides what they do when making little tiny little hors d'oeuvres and things. And a woman from a town called Beni Slamin, and I give her credit in the book, and I even mentioned Yavi in the book, told me this recipe. And she said, we all make it there. Because, you know, we used to see guinea hens all over Morocco, but I never saw any recipes for guinea hens. And I had also asked, what birds do you use? She says, oh, we always use guinea hens because we're in the Middle Atlas, and that's where there's a lot of wild game.
Well, Paula, thank you so very much.
Thank you for coming. It's just delightful.
Thank you to Paula Wolfert, our audience here and our listening audience. And now the program of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.